I call this meeting of the Legacy Finance Committee to order. I don't believe we have quorum yet, so we'll just move on with the agenda items. Our first agenda item, well, today's hearing is about the impacts of Operation Metro Surge. As we all know, how ICE arrived in Minnesota about a month or two ago, and it has impacted our metro and, I believe, neighboring cities in greater Minnesota greatly. And so I wanted to use this time to allow impacted communities and organizations to share what's happening on the ground. And so I want to thank all of you for being here today to testify. And our first testifier is Aaron Johnson Ortiz, Executive Director from Neil Muralismo de Mexico.
Madam Speaker, if I may.
Representative Olson.
Thank you so much, Madam Speaker. Remember when this committee first started last year, we were asked to introduce ourselves and we were asked to say what part of the legacy funds are our favorite. And I was the only one on this side of the aisle who loudly proclaimed that the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund was my absolute favorite. I love it. And I hope that what is discussed today in no way jeopardizes my love and my support for this Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, because it truly is my favorite part of this fund. And I hope that as we're having this discussion today, we understand that there are a lot of ramifications we can have here. And I still hope that by the end of this conversation, I still truly and absolutely love the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Olson. So we'll get started with our first testifier. So please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah, good morning, buenos dias, Chairs Bang and McDonald, and members of the Legacy Committee. And my name is Aaron Johnson Ortiz. I also go by Aaron. Our nonprofit, we use the DBA of Minnesota Latino Museum, and so you can find us on our webpage, mnlatinomuseum.org, or you can also follow us on Instagram. I brought a little color packet, which I hope is in front of you. It's spiral bound. And I'm going to, if you don't mind flipping through that as we're speaking, I'd like to share some of our work as well as relevant data to this conversation. In my remarks today, there's basically six things that I wanted to express. Obviously, the first is just introducing myself. Again, my name is Aaron Johnson Ortiz. And then I want to share a little bit about data regarding Mexicans and Latinos in Minnesota and a little bit more broadly in the United States, a little bit of our context. So in other words, what we do as an organization, what's our recent work, and then talk a little bit about the impact in over the past couple months of the Metro Surge operation in Twin Cities and across the state as well on our community, on our organization, and on artists. So a little bit about myself. In addition to being a public artist, I'm a muralist. I also have a background in immigrant rights organizing. I did that kind of community organizing about a decade and a half ago, specifically under the Obama administration. And from my perspective, a lot of the failures of our immigration system have been bipartisan. There have been a lot of, in my view, unjustified profiling in our community under both Republican and Democratic administrations. However, these have changed over time, and certainly what's happened in Minnesota over the past 3 months has been particularly terrible. So I wanted to frame that to say that not only do I have expertise in arts administration, but also I have a long history of working in immigrant communities and understanding the impacts of ICE or Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So if we can flip through some of these pages, I wanted to, I think it's on about the fifth page, on the upper left corner, it says key data. And so this is basic information about non-white and immigrant communities in the state of Minnesota. This goes unnoticed, unfortunately, quite a bit, but Mexicans are the largest non-white cultural community in the state. And this is a screenshot from a Star Tribune article from 2024 based on data from the last U.S. Census. And specifically, it names the largest non-white populations in the state of Minnesota. There's about 400,000 Latinos in our state, and about two-thirds of the Latino population in the state of Minnesota is of Mexican heritage. Another key point that I always want to emphasize, and you can flip towards the next page, at the top it says 140 years of Mexican and Latino arts in Minnesota. This year specifically, we're celebrating that that milestone, 140 years. In Minneapolis in 1886, there was a large cultural event, specifically a musical event. About more than 50 musicians came from Mexico and presented for a period of 40 days. The total audience size was somewhere between above 300,000 people, so we're talking about a third of the state population. And I mention this because a lot of times when we talk about our community, we talk about immigrants who came only in the past one or two decades, but in reality, our community has been here for at least 140 years and probably longer than that. Over on the right image, there's an image of a man whose name is Luis Garzon, and he was a musician that arrived with that band in 1886, and then he went on to stay in Minnesota and create a community, open a grocery store. He led orchestra ensembles, music initiatives. He taught music to children, and so he was an arts and culture bearer who came to the state 140 years ago, and we believe that that is part of our long heritage in the state. The next page is data about the population growth of Mexican and Latinos in Minnesota. Basically, at this point, we're talking about somewhere around 400,000 people in the state who live here. And since the 1990s, there's been a significant increase of our population. And you can kind of see that in the chart where we've been here for a very long time, but the percentage of the population was quite a bit low, and then it's grown substantially over the past couple decades. You see in between the data, I included some of photos of our recent work, and so I'll get into that in a second, but that's just for your personal enjoyment and also because I'm a visual artist, so I always want to share art first and foremost. Then on page 9, the top of the page, it says three contexts. And so I want to say a couple of things about our organization. First is we are a relatively small nonprofit. Our expenses last year was around $330,000. Nevertheless, we're the largest Mexican-focused organization, not just arts organization, but organization in the state of Minnesota, which puts us in a very unique position because we know that there's a lot of nonprofits that serve various culture communities in the state of Minnesota, but Mexicans are particularly underserved in ways that are dramatically greater than other communities. Another thing I'd like to mention is our long-term vision of the Minnesota Latino Museum is for Hareid Island in St. Paul. And we know that from federal data, there's about 35,000 museums in the United States. The museums focus on the Latino community number around 30 to 35, so we're talking about one in 1,000 or 0.1%, whereas we're about 20% of the U.S. population. Page 10, that's just a screenshot from that study from, I believe it was 2014, from IMLS, which is the Institute for Museum and Library Services. That's a federal entity that is tasked with museum and libraries. Okay, at the beginning of last year, we had a wonderful article in NPR talking about our proposed museum, and specifically we wanted to talk about the museum within the context of this 100-year heritage, right, 100-year-plus heritage, again, because so much of the conversation about our community is about recent history, but we really want to emphasize the long history of our community in the state. And then page 13 is just a little outline of you know, where we want to do the museum in St. Paul. And some highlights of our work. In 2022, we organized the first Day of the Dead altar here at the state capitol. And Governor Walz issued a state proclamation recognizing Day of the Dead in Minnesota and recognizing our work. And we didn't know this at the time, but through that proclamation, Minnesota became the first state in the United States to officially recognize Day of the Dead, which is a very important tradition for our community. One more thing, and I'm going to go over some of the data from last year specifically. We did a very large exhibit at Raspberry Island in St. Paul. It's on the Mississippi River. With these giant paper mache sculptures, they're called alebrijes. And we had over 300,000 visitors, which was really a record for actually any arts opera, art exhibit in the state of Minnesota, certainly for an organization of our size. We had over 1 million views on our Instagram. It had the highest earned media coverage of any art exhibit. And again, I'm comparing to Mia and The Walker, which have, you know, $20 to $40 million operating budgets. So we're tiny in comparison, and yet the impact of our work has been significant. And I do want to take the moment to just thank the Legacy Committee, because we have received quite a bit of funds to do this work. And so thank you for your support of our work and our community. Next page is outreach project. So it just talks a little bit about some of our work in Greater Minnesota, in Red Wing, in Austin, in Worthington, and Duluth. We do public art, we do pop-up exhibits, we do arts workshops. So just to avoid taking up too much time and leaving time for questions, I want to jump ahead to the next couple slides quickly. The blue slide, which says Mall of America at the top, specifically went over our a weekend of activities at Mall of America in 2024. We had 60,000 in-person viewers and visitors and 7,000 workshop participants. Again, we're a tiny nonprofit, but it was the largest event in Minnesota organized by a Latino nonprofit that year. Again, we do a lot with very little money. And then just to jump forward, we have a slide about our workshops. And lastly, I just wanted to highlight the turquoise slide that says Minnesota Latino Museum budget versus impact. And specifically, I want to highlight with this slide the level of impact that our organization has with the few number of dollars that we receive. It's somewhat standard for Minnesota museums, art museums specifically, to spend somewhere between $50 and $150 per visitor. In other words, that's comparing their annual operating expenses to their total annual visitors. So, for example, a large museum in Minnesota might have 500 to 700,000 visitors, but have, you know, upwards of $40 million in expenses. It's about $90 per visitor. We managed last year to have an attendance of about $1 per visitor. So we're just really at the cutting edge of cost efficiency for the state of Minnesota. All right, let's move forward here to number five, which is ICE Metro Surge. It's about three pages ahead. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead. I want to leave time for questions. I want to speak a little bit about some fundamental data that is really important for policymakers to understand when it comes to immigrants. I hear the term immigrant thrown around quite a bit, but it's very important to understand that when we're talking about immigration policy in the United States, as well as in Minnesota, we're first and foremost talking about Mexicans. And the reason I say that, and you can see the data right there, Mexicans are the largest immigrant population in the country. We're also the largest immigrant population in Minnesota by quite a bit, actually. The deportation numbers, that's page 23, and this is from 2021 to 2024, so obviously these numbers have changed in recent years, but the primary community that's been targeted for deportations has been Mexicans, as well as to a lesser degree Central Americans and South Americans. Okay, we move forward one more page, ICE deportation flights. So this is slightly more recent data that's from 2025, and these are under the Trump administration flights out of the country. And as you can see, the great majority are Central America, as well as Mexico, and a little bit the rest of Latin America. Okay, unfortunately, I don't have any 2026 data. I was not able to find any of that online or in any of the sources from, earned media reports from this year from Minnesota specifically. So I don't know exactly the exact numbers of communities that were targeted by ICE Metro Surge. I do know that the policy, or at least the stated policy of the administration, has been to expand deportation efforts, and oftentimes target folks who are or have a citizen status. Sometimes they have green cards, and so on and so forth. And so the kind of scope of who is being targeted under Metro Surge was pretty much quite a bit expanded from previous years under ICE. For us as an organization, and just as an impact to us as both as artists, as community members. I did want to highlight our numbers from last year to really signal, you know, we do, when we do workshops, when we do exhibits, we get, you know, hundreds of people, sometimes tens of thousands of people, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people. We had a workshop this weekend on Saturday, and there was three people who showed up. We had a workshop 2 weeks ago. You know, we were lucky that we had, you know, 10 people show up. And so for us, this is really not consistent with, you know, the size of our community. It's not consistent with the historic impact of our work. If you go from 1 year of having a total audience size of over 300,000 to going to the first quarter of 2026 of having an audience size of under 100 people, you can see that there's a ginormous impact of Metro Surge in Minnesota. Lastly, I just want to thank our funders, and I want to leave some time for questions from the committee members.
Thank you, Executive Director Aaron. So we have about 4 minutes for questions. Do we have any questions from members? Representative Hussein.
Thank you, Aaron. And I was there, the exhibit in downtown St. Paul, and it was very attractive and beautiful. It attracted a lot of people. This is an empty land, but you created a beautiful art that reflect the West Side, our Latino community, and the Pie Park. And this attract hundreds of people that I witnessed. The great work that you're doing is something that really needed in the state of Minnesota, and that's why I'm sitting in this committee to support, because I am passionate about arts and cultural musics. And this beautiful, and I can't wait this summer. I brought my son, who is into arts and culture, and he's keep asking, it's like, is it gonna be available this summer? So you guys continue. This will be available for people to come visit and doing this the same event that you have done in the past.
Well, first of all, thank you, Representative, for your support of our work and also for showing up to our art exhibit, especially the ribbon cutting last May, I believe, May 30th, I think it was. We do not have an exhibit plan for Raspberry Island this year. In part because we're going to be focusing more on our capital campaign this year. We really want to develop the museum and then develop a more kind of permanent sculpture park in the area, and we're working with the City of St. Paul for that purpose. That location is important for our community. It's the first Latino barrio in the state of Minnesota. It's the first Mexican neighborhood in the state of Minnesota, so it has historical importance. And then secondly, you know, if we had organized the exhibit we did last year, if we had organized it this year, most likely we would have had to cancel. So we did not have something of that scale planned for this year, but I feel lucky that we didn't do that because we put in a lot of energy, a lot of time, and a lot of money. And to see that go to waste, it would have been heartbreaking. I know the impact on our community has been terrible. On us as an organization, I guess it was just lucky timing that we were able to do that last year and not this year.
Representative Hussein.
Thank you. This is something that I was looking forward to this summer again, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay. Further question, we could take one more. Okay. Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Johnson Ortiz. Thank you for being here today. Next we have is Fran DeLeon, Artistic Director from Theater Mu. And after her, we'll have Laura Zabo, Executive Director from Springboard for the Arts. So Fran, as you make your way to the testifying table, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to testify today, Madam Chair Vang. This is my first time testifying here in Minnesota. I am a recent transplant from Los Angeles. Just last week, though, I am officially a resident, and I received my Minnesota driver's license to the chagrin of my California folks. My name is Fran De Leon. I am the artistic director of Theater Moo. 33 years in operation, we are the largest Asian American theater in the Midwest, second in the nation. I was appointed artistic director in June of 2025 and thrilled to relocate here in the greater Minneapolis-St. Paul area that has a robust and vibrant theater community. My biggest concern was how I was going to adjust to the weather. But I took a lot of advice from locals. I armed myself with a full-length down coat, scarves, gloves, knit caps. I learned how to walk and shuffle, leaning forward on the ice like Tim Conway from the Carol Burnett Show. The climate I did not prepare for was a city to be occupied by ICE agents, the disappearing of our neighbors, the murders of American citizens, and the difficult decisions that I have had to face as an artistic leader. We have had to cancel school programs because children were afraid to go to school. On the weekend of January 23rd, Theater Moo was set to present our longest-running program, the New Eyes Festival. We programmed two nights of a 10-minute play festival featuring the work of playwrights selected from a nationwide pool responding to the prompt, "What does freedom mean to you?" We also coupled that with a preview reading of our spring production coming up in April, entitled Hmong Futures by Katie Kaweng. As the festival approached, it was announced that the Twin Cities would be observing the Day of Truth and Freedom on January 23rd, the first night of our readings. I had to question whether Theater Moo should participate in the strike and shut down. But after consulting with other artistic directors, with our funders, program officers, we came to the realization that Theater Moo was not a part of the problem, but part of the solution. We decided that we would go ahead with the festival, prepare well-planned emergency action procedures, and provide a space for the audience to commune afterwards. We had no agenda for these post-show gatherings, other than to serve as a time for us to be in community in an environment that was warm, both in temperature and in heart. In spite of what we had been facing, after the readings delivered by some of the Twin Cities treasured actors, the lobby was filled with smiles and hugs and even laughter. It was a wonderful respite from the intense amounts of cortisol that had been infiltrating our veins. It was exactly what we needed, but those feelings didn't last very long. The following morning, I received a text from our production manager. An observer was shot by Glam Doll Donuts. I'm shaking. The observer, of course, was Alex Preddy, and the light and joy and the relief that we all received the night before was unceremoniously snuffed out and replaced with grief and fear and frantically checking our contact sheets to see who of our staff lived in the area and were they safe. And thankfully there were, physically, anyway. So despite the old theater adage of the show must go on, we made the difficult decision to cancel the rest of our programs. How could we, an Asian American theater company, put at risk our artists who walk the earth in skin that is vulnerable to raids and detentions? How could we, while agents knocked on doors, asking, where are the Asians? Where are the Hmong? Call attention to a reading of a play called Hmong Futures. Despite the cancellations, all the actors, contractors, and venue rental fees were paid as agreed upon. We held a Zoom call with artists to check in, and while I must respect their privacy and not provide details, I can share my heartbreak in seeing these Asian American artists allowing their sentiments of damage and fracture bring them to tears, how broken and betrayed they felt in their own hometown. Not long after we made another difficult decision to cancel our annual Lunar New Year fundraiser and all of our fundraising efforts in a fiscal year where Theater Moo is already experiencing a volatile financial environment with sunsetting grants, diminishing federal funding, and costs for production nearly doubled. Canceling a night of pledges and paddle raises was the farthest thing from a smart decision for our financial health. But with members of our Asian Minnesotan community sheltering at home, our staff delivering groceries and diapers and formula and making cash donations out of their own pockets for rental assistance, we could not in good conscience sell tickets for a dress-up event. We could not host Lunar New Year, which is a time that we are supposed to focus on family and good fortune, ask our supporters to gussy up and celebrate and start the evening out by doling out instructions of what to do should ICE infiltrate the Hollywood Theater. And we could not ask that they put themselves at risk to support the art of the beloved institution that is Theater Moo. Instead, we invited our supporters to focus their donations and support local immigrant-owned small businesses, give gifts of mutual aid, or sponsor a meal for families in need. NPR featured our stories. Playbill wrote an article, which is in your packet. We received emails of support, including one from someone in Moorhead who wrote, "The balance you are striking between commitments and emergency response is healthier and more responsible in long-term sustainability of community. Thank you for the example of strength and empathy that Theater Moo is setting." Time being of the essence for the full production of Hmong Futures, we went ahead with our auditions. One actor told us that it was the first time she'd been out to do anything, that she had been staying home for a month, that her cousin was detained, and that her sister had at one point been pulled from her car. Following those auditions, we received an email from another actor who wrote, "I've been struggling to feel in tune with myself and my art during the height of everything going on, as many have, and it was such a pleasure to come in tonight and tap back into what I love, especially at a place that I truly call home. Thank you for providing that space." And right here in the Capitol on Arts Advocacy Day, which Mr. Chairman McDonald, I was delighted to see you there and for you to declare that you too are an artist. We all agree that art is essential. So now, almost 2 months later, we are feeling the pressure and the repercussions to our organization's already precarious financial health. As theater makers and people of color, we have always worked with the pressure of a proverbial thumb pushing us down, and yet we continue to exist. We thrive by knowing how to achieve multiple goals at once. As creatives, we know the power of collaboration. To that extent, we are collaborating and partnering to serve all of those who are affected by Operation Metro Surge. We will record a podcast at St. Paul Neighborhood Network to counteract beliefs that the operation did no harm. We will disseminate boots on the ground information to raise our voices beyond the Twin Cities. Episode's guests will include an artist activist on national stature, a local grassroots activist, and uplift a local business in a reverse form of the traditional podcast, where rather than have them pay us to be featured, we will pay them to promote their business. We are grateful for the rapid response assistance from the Jerome Foundation, Arts Midwest, the Women's Foundation, and the Wallace Foundation that will make that possible. We will host a ticketed event in a partnership with Urban Growler in St. Paul to bring them business and to solicit some income and donations for us. Artists will donate their time to perform, and attendees will be asked to bring food donations to be delivered to Keystone Community Food Shelf. I've been asked by friends and family back home, if I had known then what I know now, would I have turned down the position to to lead an arts organization in this time and space? And my answer is a resounding no. Because despite the atrocities, what I have witnessed are Minnesotan solidarity, strength, and care for neighbors unlike anything I have ever seen. So I am proud to carry this license along with my passport in my purse every day. I feel privileged to be in community with those who reflect the true spirit of what it means to be a Minnesotan and an American. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Frandilone. We have time for one or two questions from members. Representative Cha.
Thank you for being here. I'm also from California. I want to share with you that the occupation of ICE does not represent the legislator or those of us that are in the state. I'm proud to serve in this legislation as a refugee, as a member of this committee. I'm also very proud to sit across from my colleagues across the aisle who have been in partnership with our caucus to make Minnesota what it is. Reassuring you, thank you.
Thank you. Further remarks, questions? Thank you, Director Frandilone. I would have loved to see the play Hmong Futures. The reading of that would have been amazing. Please let me know if there are future opportunities. It is unfortunate that had to be canceled and the tough decisions that you guys
Well, we did not cancel the production, so you are all invited. Please come see it. We are running from April to May, so we are going forth with the full production.
All right. That's really good to hear. So I will make an effort to attend a production. And with that, we have next is Laura Zabel, Executive Director for Springboard for the Arts. And we are a bit on a time crunch here, so if please, members, keep your remarks concise. And if the testimony from the testifier under 7 minutes, 5 to 7 minutes if possible. And proceed, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Chair Vang and members of the committee. My name is Laura Zabel. I am the executive director of Springboard for the Arts. Springboard is a 35-year-old nonprofit organization that's based both here in St. Paul and in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. We work with over 20,000 artists in Minnesota every year. Those artists are creative workers and small business owners, and Springboard provides entrepreneurship training and opportunities for artists to do projects that impact their communities. The artists that we work with are teaching in schools and after-school programs. They're addressing social isolation and elder care. They're helping rural communities attract and retain young people and creating the culture that defines Minnesota as a vibrant and desirable place to live, work, and raise a family. This cultural work, much like caregiving and community work, is labor that is vital to the health of our communities and our state, but isn't always compensated or compensated fairly. Like other small business owners and gig workers, artists are disproportionately self-employed and often have very variable income. And this cultural work that they do is vital in times of crisis. And Minnesota's artists have stepped up over the last several months in incredible ways to support our communities. Through Springboard's Artist Respond program, artists have been delivering small, neighborhood-scale, community-focused projects all across the state. And with private funding, we've been able to support over 60 projects so far, including a community dinner that paired shared food with art making and a free market in Winona, a community mosaic where families painted pieces of the mosaic at home and then assembled into a collective piece, which allowed people to participate on their own schedule but still contribute to something collective in Wilmar, community meals and craft making in Maple Grove, a potluck and community gathering in Rondo in St. Paul using shared food and storytelling to strengthen neighborhood bonds, and home-based art kits for families in Bloomington that were distributed through a PTO network and elementary schools, and many, many, many more. One of the most important roles that artists have played in the last several months is helping to share Minnesota's story and culture with the world in moments when we are in the spotlight. There are groups like Brass Solidarity, a community brass band that welcomes all participants that have performed at literally hundreds of events, sharing opportunities for music, connection, and joy amidst pain and fear and grief. Videos of these performances have traveled all around the world, showing people the depth of Minnesota's culture and commitment to one another. Nearly $1 million was raised through Minnesota concerts and musicians in less than a month. And artists all across the state have raised millions more for food shelves, rent relief, and other urgent needs through cabarets, poetry readings, jewelry and pottery sales, using their art and giving up their compensation to keep neighbors housed and fed and small businesses open. There are some really unique parts of Minnesota's ecosystem that contribute to the depth of the creative response here. Minnesota has a long history of artists rooted in community work and working at the intersections of art and other community needs. And artists in Minnesota view their artistry as integral to, not separate from, their identity as a neighbor and a community member. And Minnesota has a very strong ecosystem of locally rooted cultural organizations all across the state that have very deep trust with their communities. And even in a time when there's a lot of narrative and discourse around trust in larger institutions failing, these local groups are trusted resources and gathering spaces in their neighborhoods and towns. And artists in Minnesota face many of the same challenges as artists all across the country: reliance on gig work, little to no safety nets or protections, lack of affordable options for healthcare and housing, et cetera. We do have more support that focuses on the people who make the art than many other places in this country. Minnesota is home to statewide artist fellowship programs, rural and urban city governments that hire artists to lead community participation and community problem-solving projects. We have an excellent network of regional arts councils that serve every county in the state and numerous artist service organizations. And Minnesota has consistently been on the leading edge of innovative system changes to support creative workers, including the nation's longest-running guaranteed income pilot for artists. And of course, the Legacy Amendment, which is a national model for how to support statewide quality of life and local economic investment. For the most part, all these programs I just talked about didn't pay artists to do these projects over the last several months, but they did create an infrastructure that it makes it possible to be an artist in Minnesota and to have the will and creativity to show up in times of crisis. And it is also true that many of Minnesota's artists have put their lives on hold and held our community together for 3 months now at great cost to their own economic stability and at great risk to their own safety. 2 weeks ago, Springboard opened an application for a privately funded small business relief grant program for creative businesses. We already have over 140 applications, and we expect the number to double before the deadline. We currently have the capacity to support only 50. These creative businesses are vital to our local economies. They are businesses that are built to stay local. These are businesses that fill small town Main Street storefronts. They provide essential programming for young people. They provide opportunities for us to gather and know our neighbors, and they help us build a culture of creativity and innovation statewide. So as we all begin to grapple with the deep damage to our economy and our community and our long, long road to recovery, we need to make sure we protect and support our artists and culture bearers, because we have certainly learned how much we need their work, their creativity, and their imagination to hold us together, to sustain us, and to tell our story to the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Executive Director Laura. Remarks or questions from members? Representative Hussein?
Good to see you, and see you. Thanks for coming forward. And I'm happy to have this organization in my district. And not only that you support artists, but also you provide skills, technicals, and you guys created more arts. And, you know, like if it comes to digitals, and I have been in this space, and you guys bring great events as well. So I just want to thank you. And at the same time, now you are helping small businesses within our state and in the district. We thank you for this organization and the great work you guys do, and I'm honored to support. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Any further questions, remarks? All right, seeing none, thank you, Executive Director Laura, for all the work that you guys do. Next we have is Diane Creason, President from the Minnesota Children's Museum. And then up next after that is Ryan French, Managing Director from Minnesota Children's Theater, who is virtual. Diane, welcome. Please proceed. Introduce yourself for the record.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm Diane Kreisen, President of Minnesota Children's Museum, and I want to thank Madam Chair, Chair McDonald, committee members for the invitation to testify today. Minnesota Children's Museum is a museum that serves our young children, ages 10 and under, and their families. Our mission is to spark children's learning through play. Play is how young children figure out their world, how they wire their brain, and develop just a wonderful set of skills that serves them well throughout the rest of their life. I am here to talk specifically about what we saw at the Children's Museum, the impact from the surge. For us, we had a dramatic drop in attendance at the museum, starting in late December through February. We saw a 20% drop in attendance, and that resulted in about a $200,000 loss to the organization, which as a nonprofit organization was not something that we could absorb. And so unfortunately, last week we had to announce to our staff a workforce reduction in order to just address, you know, what wasn't a financially viable situation to continue on as we had plans for the year. We received many phone calls from visitors asking about ice activity in the area, and while it's impossible for us to know who didn't feel comfortable coming to the museum, I can share more details from the 17 field trips that were canceled from that. You know, those they cited safety concerns for their students as the reason for those 17 cancellations, and they were from all over. They're from the north, Chisago Lakes, Forest Lakes, Brooklyn Park. From the south, Prior Lake, Burnsville, Bloomington. To the west, Minnetonka and Wayzata, and even further out from Rockford and Minnetrista, you know, where we saw cancellations. And even we had planned a group of students from Annunciation Catholic School in Minneapolis. And talk about a group of students that could really use some joy in their life, but they had to cancel for safety concerns as well, too. I also wanted to touch on the impact on our staff who felt fearful for their own safety. They were scared with ice activity in their neighborhoods, you know, as well as afraid to use public transportation, particularly our colleagues with brown and black skin. The majority of our workforce that must come to the museum to work, that do not have the option to work from hybrid because we are, you know, operating a museum, 40% of our staff are BIPOC. For that, and you know, didn't have a choice of coming to work if they were going to, you know, do their jobs. For that, we did some organizing of pickup rides so public transportation could be avoided to accommodate as much as possible. We were also seeing our volunteers of color, in particular, were dropping their shifts during this time period. And frankly, I also heard from board members who are corporate executives sharing how they did not leave home or let their children leave home without their passports for proof of citizenship. So this is a lot of stress and anxiety that people were experiencing. And so as a children's museum, what we did that we felt like we could uniquely make a difference of support during this time period is we particularly focused on children who were staying at home because of concerns of safety for leaving the home. We assembled 600 Tinker kits. You know, these kits included things like, you know, tubes, cloth, cups, springs, other colorful materials. I was going to bring a show and tell, but we distributed all of them. for that. And there were no directions. It was really just prompts to encourage creative thinking and imagination with that as well. And we, I only had, could find some cards that we inserted in that in four different languages that just talks about how play helps and heals in that. Play is powerful. It brings families together, sparks joy, and reduces stress from the negative effects of stress and anxiety with that. And so we worked through partners, others who were doing food delivery to make that happen. And just wanted to acknowledge that we did not use any state funds for that project, but just wanted to lean in and do something where we felt like we could uniquely support children who were experiencing stress. So just in the spirit of, I know you're tight for time, I think those are my key messages I wanted to share.
Thank you, President Diane. Any question, remarks from members? All right, thank you. This is incredibly important that you are here today to share this story, because when children cannot go out to play, there is something wrong in this world. So thank you for all the work that you're doing. Next we have is Ryan French, who will be testifying virtually. Do we have that ready? Ryan, if you can hear us, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi there, good morning. Thank you to the leadership and to the committee for inviting me here today. My name is Ryan French. I'm managing director at Children's Theater Company in the Whittier neighborhood of Minneapolis. I'm also a proud resident of St. Paul. Children's Theater Company is the largest and most acclaimed theater for young people in the nation. We're the only children's theater in America to have won a Tony Award for Outstanding Regional Theater, and we're located right here in Minneapolis. We produce 6 to 8 shows a year and teach classes in our building and summer camps across the Twin Cities, and partners with the Park and Rec boards and with the schools. In any given year, we welcome over 200,000 people to our campus. And last year, we welcomed visitors from 83 of the 87 Minnesota counties. So we truly serve the entire state. I work at CTC because of the transformative impact we have on children and families in our community and the leadership role we play nationally with other not-for-profit theaters. We're grateful for the public support we receive from the Minnesota State Arts Board and the Legacy Amendment. And I thank you for your support of the arts and for some time to tell our story today. This past January, CTC planned to open a long-awaited production of Go Dog Go, Ve Piro Ve, which is a stage adaptation of the beloved children's book by P.D. Eastman. I'm sure many of you know that book either from your childhood or perhaps from a young person in your life. This show was special in that it was bilingual. It was equally weighted in English and Spanish. It was an important way for CTC to reach out to and celebrate our Latino neighbors and partners. When ticket sales were slower than typical shows in this time period leading up to January, we started to dig deeper and learned that CTC as a destination was not unlike other businesses and schools. Many families did not want to leave their homes or neighborhoods because they did not feel safe at that time. Now, this is anecdotal. Again, there's no way to prove every single person that did not leave, but we work with a number of partners who shared that information with us. One of the ways we thought we could give back was to, during the run of Go Dog Go, organize a food drive through our partners at Community Aid Network Minnesota, CAN-MN. And so we asked the patrons that were coming to the theater on opening night and for the entire run of the show to bring non-perishable food. It was just one small gesture we could do to help out our neighbors. And of course, no state dollars were used for that. That was just simply a drop-off site for people to bring in non-perishable items. On Friday evening, January 23rd, we had our opening night performance of Go Dog Go, and while it was a much smaller house than we typically expect, the show was beautiful and well-received, and the cast and crew were super proud, and that CAN-MN bin of non-perishables was overflowing. But things changed dramatically at 9 a.m. on the morning of January 24th when Alex Purdy was shot just 3 blocks from CTC. We had already started classes in our education wing that morning with close to 100 students in the building. And when news broke and crowds started coming to the neighborhood, we knew we had to act quickly. We followed our security protocols and we worked closely in collaboration with our other partners on campus, the Minneapolis College of Art and Design and the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. We needed to determine our next steps. Since many parents drop their children off at the theater and then go about their Saturday morning errands, we decided the safest thing to do was to continue holding classes for our morning session and cancel classes in the afternoon. We needed to keep the kids safe. That is our number one priority. And the parents were grateful that that was the decision we made. As crowds continued to show up on campus, we knew we had to cancel our performances of that same show that weekend. And then once the National Guard was announced with their perimeter closure, we ended up canceling four shows that weekend on what was a 45-show run. We were grateful and relieved when that perimeter was lifted and the National Guard was able to depart, but the community was scared after that. They were scared to leave their homes. They were scared to come to the Whittier neighborhood. And our employees, who also live in the neighborhood, were scared. Even some of our board members changed their behaviors and stopped coming in person and would only use remote options to join in on meetings. This meant the entire run of the show was now in jeopardy. In the end, 21 schools, accounting for over 1,500 students, canceled their field trips. And the general public, who come to shows that aren't designed for field trips, were also slow in coming to the show. Many shared with us they did not feel safe leaving their homes or coming to the neighborhood. In total, CTC lost about $230,000 in ticket revenue during January and February over the course of those 45 performances. Lost ticket revenue is only part of the problem. That's the economic impact. But equally important is our inability to deliver on a world-class theater experience to more people. For many, those performances would have been their first-time theater experience for a child, or perhaps a grandparent's long-planned trip with their little ones. At CTC, our vision is to create a better world with, for, and through young people. We are now making hard decisions, including workforce reduction decisions, required to balance our budget in the remaining months of this fiscal year that ends in June. So while we are stressed and the economic pain is real, we remain committed to the power of theater to educate, challenge, and inspire young people. And on the bright side, that little donation drive we did with CanMN, we closed the run of the show on February 22nd, and that small gesture turned into a bounty. We had a cargo van full of canned goods and diapers and more that we took to CanMN, and it was the one gesture we could do coming out of this. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Director Ryan. Question, remarks from members? Seeing none. Thank you, Director Ryan, for your testimony and for all the work that you guys are doing, the impact that you have in our region. Next we have is Jen Hensley, President and CEO of the Bakken Museum. And right after her, we have Peng Yang, Executive Director from Minnesota Jigjaw, and Megan Budke from Emerging Indigenous and World Languages Coordinator. So Jen Hensley, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Vang, Chair McDonald, and the rest of the committee. Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jen Hensley. I serve as the President and CEO of the Bakken Museum in Minneapolis. For those of you who may not know us, the Bakken is a museum dedicated to exploring the intersection of science, innovation, and the humanities. Each year, we serve thousands of Minnesota students statewide through field trips, outreach, and hands-on STEM learning experiences. We also turned 50 last year. I'm here to share what we have experienced during Operation Metro Surge, how it affected our organization, and how we responded in support of students. Like many organizations across the Twin Cities, we saw immediate impacts. In December, our attendance dropped by about 21% compared to normal levels, while December is usually a full and joyful holiday season when we welcome many visitors through our doors. In January and February, that decline deepened significantly. During those 2 months, we saw roughly a 44% reduction in attendance and programs. For a museum like ours, that kind of drop is dramatic. Much of it was driven by school field trips canceling, schools having safety concerns or logistical challenges transporting students during this period of uncertainty. When schools cancel, it doesn't just affect our attendance numbers, it means students miss out on hands-on science learning experiences, and our staff feel the loss of doing what they love. For many children, those field trips are their first interaction with a museum or with STEM learning in a hands-on environment. But even as attendance dropped, our mission didn't. We asked ourselves a simple question: how can we continue serving students who can't come to us? One of the ways we responded was by helping assemble and distribute STEM and arts learning kits for students who were learning from home. At the Bakken, we helped prepare and pack 600 color chemistry kits designed for students in fourth through sixth grades. These kits provided students with a chance to explore the concept of natural pigments. They literally took beetles and pea flower and created an entire palette of colors by changing pH. And then they were able to create whatever they could imagine through watercolor with that. This was all while engaging with an important STEM concept. When we decided to do these kits, we put a simple call out asking for help within our community, literally just a simple social media post. And the response from our community was remarkable. We had several times the number of volunteers needed to sign up to help assemble these kits. In total, 50 community members came together one evening to pack these 600 kits. Many told us that they simply wanted a way to help students and families during this difficult time. That level of response told us something important. People want to show up for kids and learning. These kits allow students to create colors, experiment, paint, and explore the intersection of science and art at home with the same spirit of curiosity that is sparked with an experience inside of our museum. And most importantly, these kits were provided at no cost to the students who received them. That matters deeply to us. But the creation of these kits and these alternative learning methods also creates financial pressure at a time when revenue streams are greatly reduced. When attendance drops by nearly half during what is normally a strong field trip season, it becomes much harder to cover ongoing expenses, let alone provide additional kits. Despite that challenge, we are exploring ways to expand this effort, including a potential buy one, give one model that would allow supporters to help fund additional kits for students statewide across Minnesota who need them the most. What we've learned through this experience is that museums can be incredibly nimble. Museums are not just places people visit, they are part of our community infrastructure. We are classrooms, we are gathering spaces, and increasingly we are partners in ensuring learning continues even when traditional systems are disrupted. It's also important to note that many cultural institutions were already navigating challenging financial conditions. Across the country and here in Minnesota, organizations have seen reductions in federal funding streams. The Bakken has been fortunate to maintain our small amount of federal funding, but many of our peers have not been so fortunate. Based on conversations with colleagues at related institutions, the financial pressures are being felt across the sector. When attendance declines at the same time funding becomes uncertain, the strain compounds quickly. And yet, we as museums continue to step up, we adapt, we collaborate, we find ways to keep serving Minnesota's children and family. State support through programs like the Legacy Amendment plays a critical role in ensuring that arts, cultural, and education institutions remain strong and accessible to all Minnesotans, especially during moments when communities need them most. I'll close with this. Even in the midst of disruption, our staff and volunteers remain focused on one thing: showing up for Minnesota students. Whether welcoming the school groups that could still visit, adding staff support to help students feel safe loading and unloading buses, or packing hundreds of color chemistry kits for kids studying from home, we showed up. And we will continue to show up for Minnesota's children, families, and communities, no matter the circumstances. Thank you for your time and for your supports of arts, culture, and learning across our state. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, President Jen. Remarks and questions from the committee? All right, seeing none, thank you so much for all the work that and for being here too. Next we have is Peng Yang, Executive Director from Minnesota Jaijiao, and Megan Butke from the St. Paul Public Schools. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Vang and Chair McDonald, along with members of the committee. My name is Bang Yang. I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Jaijiao. I'm also a Hmong language instructor. Minnesota Jaijiao is a Minnesota 501(c)(3) that empowers the Hmong community by nurturing the Hmong language, healing through the arts and wellness, and across generations. Because Minnesota Jaijiao is a grassroots Hmong educator-led organization, the recent climate surrounding ICE enforcement has created significant anxiety and strains within our schools and communities. Behind the calm faces and joyful lessons of BIPOC-led leaders and teachers, quietly, anxiety and fear consume their thoughts, at times 24 hours a day, uncertain if they are able to return to their classrooms and schools the next day. BIPOC teachers have had to navigate complex and distressing situations, enduring emotional and psychological trauma. Their nervous system constantly pushed them into fight or flight mode as they risk and make personal sacrifices for students. In fact, a few of our BIPOC Asian teachers who have never sought mental health therapy in the past had to, just to be able to make it through the last few months and to finish the year strong. Their reason for seeking mental health support was due to the impact of ICE operations in the community and their classrooms, and in their classrooms. Through ICE operations the last few months, multiple Hmong language teachers have shared how it brought them and their elderly parents back to the trauma inflicted 50 years ago when they fled Longjiang, Laos to flee the communist Petet Lao after the Vietnam War. Their fear, safety, and security are all coming back. And in these moments at our schools, our teachers don't have time to process their own their worries, as they have to put the safety and well-being above their own needs. This work has required educators to go beyond their contractual responsibilities, often dedicating countless hours to ensure their students remain supported and connected. However, this ongoing pressure has taken a significant toll, particularly on teachers and leaders from BIPOC communities, who themselves feel targeted and vulnerable in the current climate. Supporting BIPOC teachers and leaders is not just a moral obligation, but an investment in the future of our communities. We must honor their resilience and stand in solidarity with them. For Minnesota Jaijiao as an organization, these circumstances have required major adjustments. Our in-personal affinity spaces for Hmong educators had to be moved online to help them process the trauma. And parent engagement programs were delayed because many families were understandably afraid to even attend gatherings, even those held within school settings. We had to question whether if parents would send their kids to our ICE Thrive summer camp this summer. There were so many uncertainties. Organization leaders that I've connected with, we've had to shoulder the emotional weight of supporting communities during a time of fear and uncertainty while trying to maintain our own well-being. The cumulative impact has been exhausting and will take years and even decades to heal. BIPOC nonprofit leaders and educators are deeply fatigued, responding not only to the immediate effects of ICE enforcement in Minnesota, but also at broader federal policy changes that are reducing available fundings and making grants increasingly competitive. These pressures will inevitably affect the capacity of small community-based nonprofits to continue to provide critical support to educators in the years ahead. Sustaining funding is essential to ensure that organizations like Minnesota Jesuit and others can remain stable and continue serving the communities that depend on them most. Thank you.
Thank you, Executive Director Peng. Megan, please proceed with testimony. Introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Megan Budke, and I work as the Immersion Indigenous and World Language Coordinator for St. Paul Public Schools. In my role, I oversee 5 dual language immersion programs, 13 Indigenous and World Languages, and the Bilingual SEAL program. And I'm here today to share how Operation Metro Surge has impacted our community, particularly our language and culture schools, which support the intersection of language, culture, and identity. Our dual language immersion and language and culture schools have a large population of students and staff that identify as people of color, as well as immigrants and refugees. Operation Metro Surge has deeply impacted our district, and in particular, these specific school communities. In January, St. Paul Public Schools offered our families the option to continue school in person or to attend school virtually. At its peak, 7,500 students were registered for temporary virtual learning across our 69 schools, which is nearly 25% of our total student population. And while virtual attendance varied across schools within our district, our schools that support our language learners were heavily impacted, with some of those schools seeing close to 50% of the students registered for temporary virtual learning. Our students and families were greatly impacted by what was happening to their friends, family members, and neighbors. Watching the detainment of family, friends, and their community elders is a traumatic experience. And experiencing trauma makes it extremely difficult for our students to learn and be productive at school, whether it's in person or virtual. To support our students, our dual language immersion teachers have been providing both in-person and virtual lessons in French, Hmong, Mandarin, Chinese, and Spanish. Some teachers have been teaching newly formed in-person classes, and others are teaching newly formed live virtual classes. Many of our language teachers were teaching full days, and then they're creating virtual lessons after school and on the weekends to ensure our students get continuous access to language. Amidst all this work, our teachers, who often identify as teachers of color, as well as immigrants and refugees, they were facing their own hardships. Many of them did not feel safe coming to school. They shared with me that family, friends, and colleagues were driving them to and from work. However, if ICE was heavily present in their neighborhoods that day, they were unable to come to work. Community events hosted by our school and our district, such as our District Korean New Year celebration and one of our Chinese New Year celebrations, have been postponed and rescheduled because it has not been safe for our community to gather in a public space. Staff have been unable to fully administer assessments, such as the required Read Act literacy screenings, access tests that provide services to our multilingual students, and bilingual SEAL assessments for recognition and college credit for the multilingual skills of our students. This impacts the data we have to support our students. We don't yet know the academic impact of Operation Metro Surge, but we're preparing to support students and teachers living through the trauma that this has inflicted upon our community. Despite these challenges, we have also seen glimpses of community resilience and support. Schools in our district have turned empty classrooms and conference rooms into supply rooms. Teachers, families, and community members have donated food and hygiene items to support those who did not feel safe enough to leave their homes. Staff and parent volunteers have organized and delivered these much-needed supplies to families. When the end of the month came, housing assistance funds were organized to help families be able to make their rent and their mortgage payments. Staff members have personally shared with me that they have taken in friends and family into their own homes, or they held tender spaces of support when students were scared or sad because somebody they knew and loved had been detained. A few weeks ago, our Chinese immersion schools felt safe enough to hold their annual Chinese New Year event. The principal shared at the beginning of the event that it was a really challenging start to the new year, but she invited us to sit in the light and the warmth of the celebration. And so for 2 hours, over 1,000 Minnesotans sat in the light and the warmth of the celebration, watching our students perform. and we clapped and we cheered as our students celebrated Chinese language and culture with dance and song and vibrant colors and so, so much joy. This event is representative of what St. Paul Public Schools is, a vibrant, diverse community full of light and warmth and joy, where we celebrate languages and cultures for the gifts that they are, and where multilingualism is not just accepted, but embraced. Poet Gloria Ansel Dua wrote, "I am my language. Until I can take pride in my language, I cannot take pride in myself." Operation Metro Surge has instilled fear in our communities and dampened their pride. But it is my greatest hope for our students and for the communities that we care so deeply about, that we will again create spaces where we can all take deep pride and joy in our languages and our cultures that are so deeply rooted in our identities. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan. Remarks or questions from committee members? All right. Thank you, Executive Director Bang Yang and Coordinator Megan, for being here today and sharing and all the work that you've been doing to support our students. Next we have is Vaming Tao, founder and CEO of Asian Economic Development Association. And then we'll have a final testifier, Dr. Bruce Corey, economist, that will be testifying virtually after Vaming. Welcome to the committee, Vaming. Good to see you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Vang. Thank you, Chair McDonald. My name is Vaming Tao. It's a privilege to be here in a country that is still free. I'm here today representing the Asian Economic Development Association, or AIDA. Our mission is clear: to cultivate economic opportunities for Asian Minnesotans and foster the vibrancy of the Little Mekong Business and Cultural District in St. Paul, just one light rail stop that way on University Avenue in Western. Every year we serve 150 to 200 entrepreneurs and small businesses, and we collaborate with more than 100 artists and performers. We do this work because we know that when immigrants, refugees, and communities of color thrive economically and culturally, the state, the entire state thrives. But over the last 3 months, that vibrancy was violently suffocated. The recent Metro Surge immigration crackdown brought a heavy, intimidating ICE presence directly to our headquarters at 422 University Avenue West. In the vicinity of our building throughout the Little Mekong District and the surrounding Frogtown and Rondo neighborhoods, the fear was palpable. I personally came face to face with masked ICE agents and was afraid I was going to be roughed up and taken away. Because of this real threat of intimidation and arrest, our staff and our clients were terrified. As a result, AIDA's space, our arts and cultural space, which we call SIA Arts, a vital safe hub for arts and community, was forced to close down for 3 entire weeks. We had to cancel or indefinitely delay all of our in-person training and technical assistance for small businesses and our artist engagement programs, as well as our youth initiatives. We simply could not, in good conscience, put the safety of our community at risk. Perhaps most devastatingly, we were forced to make the agonizing decision to cancel our popular Little Mekong Night Market Street Festival for 2026. Usually happens in June. Every year, this night market draws 15,000 people to Frogtown. It is a beacon of joy, commerce, and celebration. We had to cancel it this year because we absolutely refused to allow thousands of our neighbors and families to gather, only to be made targets, sitting targets for ICE. The cancellation of this event is a massive loss of revenue for our micro-entrepreneurs, but even worse, it is an invaluable loss of community pride and cohesion. The impacts of this Metro Surge have taken a severe financial toll on AIDA as we lost critical revenue during the crackdown. But the hidden heavier cost is the mental health toll on our staff and our artists and our neighbors. These are dedicated individuals whose life's work is to care for and uplift this community. Watching the people you serve live in terror takes a toll, psychological toll. But I want to speak to something even deeper, beyond the financial statements, there is no way to quantify the loss of culture. Because we had to cancel our arts and cultural programming, our artists, makers, and cultural bearers were prevented from providing the creative expression, the celebration of our heritage that our community relies on. We as immigrants were effectively shut down as a cultural community. When a community is forced into the shadows, when it is terrified to express itself through its traditions, its art, its gatherings, its very identity is put at risk. History has shown us time and time again that when a people are forced to abandon their cultural expression out of fear, that community eventually ceases to exist. We cannot let that happen. Despite the fear, ADA is not coward. We are stepping up to support our impacted community. We refuse to be silenced. We continue to speak out against these injustices. We're promoting direct financial relief. We have cobbled together enough funding to create the Little Mekong Small Business Relief Grant. We're providing $100,000 in direct financial support to the small businesses whose livelihoods were derailed. And you can support this effort at our website, Your Business, Your Money, or yourbizmo.com. We continue to support the arts. We are bringing our youth and artists back. We are proudly supporting the Interwoven Hmong Artists Collective Benefit Concert taking place on March 21st at Maplewood Mall, which will raise funds directly for impacted families. Again, you can support this effort. Information is available on our in one of our other websites, xiaarts.com. That's xiaarts.com. I want to end on a note of hope. The spirit of Little Mekong, again, which is just steps away from here, of Frogtown, of Rondo, and of our immigrant and refugee communities is remarkably resilient. You've heard that many times. We have survived unimaginable hardships to be here, and we will survive this. But we must be honest, the impact of this crackdown will be long-lasting. Let's not fool ourselves about that, right? The trust that was broken will take years to rebuild. The path to recovery is going to be incredibly long, and we cannot walk alone in this recovery. We need everyone's support. We need our allies, our neighbors, and most importantly, we need you sitting around this room, our elected leaders, to stand with us, protect our communities, and ensure that Minnesota remains a place where cultures can live, breathe, and exist without fear. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Founder Vaming. It's really unfortunate, sad to hear that the Little Mekong Night Market would not be happening this year. I've always looked forward to it every year. And in case if members don't know what the Little Mekong is, it's basically a night market of Southeast Asian cuisine and flavors of arts and crafts and culture and performances. Really a fun street fair. For the St. Paul area district. And so thank you, Vaming, for all the work that you've done. Do we have questions or remarks from Representative Cha? So Vaming, if you can still remain at the testifying table. Representative Cha.
Just a comment. Thank you, Director Tao. As a refugee to America, I settled in St. Paul here. I grew up on Laurel, Iglehart, Capitol Heights, and on Dell. In the corner of university. So I want to thank you for your continued work in supporting this space.
Thank you.
The Mekong space, and please continue work. And please continue to work with your legislators, all 134 in the House, to continue to bring forward the voices of Little Mekong. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Chu.
Representative Hussein.
Thank you, Tao. And for sharing your stories, and many of us might not understand, but I understand.
Appreciate
because
it.
Because I'm an immigrant, what happened in our state was terrifying. We separated as citizens, a mother and son, a father and a daughter, a husband and a wife. What we have seen, I don't know how to describe it, but this will be marked in history. I was there in my district, and the story that I can't even forget about it is one of my district, her son is a citizen born here, but his dad was taken away. His mother was afraid to apply some of the services because she was a green card holder. When we call the county and we try to find some services, it was like, oh, they could come after her too. Even though she was a legally immigrant, good status, working class community, taxpayers, working two jobs to provide his family for the food at the table, paying the rent, not asking for government support. But we've taken away for those individuals that, you know, that making our society better, our state better, helping our economy, paying tax. But what we did is like we're taken away. They came to this country for better life. Immigrant, support, ran away from either from for their safety. They came to this country to grant it an opportunity for land, an opportunity, and state and the country for lived by immigrant. But it looks like we forgot our history, the long way that we came from. How do we all came together as a united? How do we support one another? But the state of Minnesota, our people stood up. When people united, they will never be defeated. They say this is unacceptable. We want to protect our immigrants because they are our neighbor. They are co-workers. They making our state better, not making bad. So I really want to thank you for coming forward and all the other testifiers who came to share with their stories. This is a land opportunity and we should not be terrifying and separating for those. I don't know how those kids will feel in the future when they grow up and they heard about their dad being detained, taken away from them, even though they came here as illegally, from applying applications and, you know, going through multiple interviews and was granted to come to America, but at the same time, we taken away and we separate him. He's born here. That terrified that child will be there forever. I mean, he will never forget because he did not get what the support and we was treated less citizens. Also, there's another story that happened in my district. One of my citizens, born and raised here in state of Minnesota, never seen in the country outside of this country, has been detained. Her dad called in my office saying, I can't find my daughter. I called the detention center, hold for hours to get answer. Once I get the answer, they were like, oh, we transfer her to Sharpen County. I say, what is she doing in Sharpen County? You know, you're detaining a U.S. citizen who hasn't done anything wrong. But she was picked up because she wasn't look like, she wasn't, we profiling people because the way they look like, the language they speak, the clothes that they're wearing, the individuals was going to get their grocery and get her medications. She also had some challenge of mental illness. In 3 days, she was locked up in Sherburne County. After her dad grabbed her passport and citizen and take it to a detention center and say, here's her citizen. They did not believe in. It was terrified the story will write in this state what happened. And many of us might not know how this racial profiling are affecting minority people, especially people of color. I want to thank you for coming forward and all other testified. It's very sad. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hussein.
Wamin, do you have any closing remarks or a response?
Not really, but I just want to say that I'm a proud Minnesotan. Came to the U.S. with my family as a refugee at 9 years old. And I want to thank you all for doing this great work of representing the state of Minnesota. And I'm proud to be a Minnesotan. I'm proud of the people here. Minnesota sometimes gets things wrong, but many times it does, get things right as well. And this is an opportunity for us to come together and do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Wamin. So members, before we move on to our final speaker, Dr. Bruce Corey, who's going to testify virtually, I want to point out to a written testimony from the International Institute of Minnesota. And it's not often that we will read written testimonies out loud, but I think this one is short enough and it's important that I want the public and members to hear from them. So, dear Chair McDonald, Chair Vang, and members of the committee, I am Jane Grotman, the Executive Director of the International Institute of Minnesota. The Institute has provided comprehensive services to immigrants in our community for 106 years, including education, workforce, immigration, and refugee services. The past 2.5 months have seen unprecedented times and actions in our community, particularly for our and toward new Americans in our state. The first case of detainment that we heard of was in early January 2026. A refugee family came to the Institute terrified after their house was surrounded by approximately 8 ICE officers with guns drawn demanding entrance to their home. The family was scared and confused and had no idea what was happening. The ICE officers took their 19-year-old son, who happened to be coming home at the time the officers were outside. The family was here legally and had no criminal record. The Institute tracked the son to the Whipple building, provided legal support, and eventually got him released. There were 14 additional refugees here in legal status who were also arrested and detained that reached out to the Institute for help. Of these 15 refugees, 14 were transported within 24 hours to Texas or Mississippi after being arrested or detained. After a week or weeks, they were released without their documents into a state they had never been in and with no idea how to get home. We had a client that was moved 3 times during detainment and another that was beaten for no reason by 4 ICE officers while in detention. The Institute had to locate these individuals and provide legal assistance to get them back home. On January 29th, the New York Times reported that there have been more than 100 cases of legal refugees arrested and detained in Minnesota. Currently, refugees and other legal residents in our states are being re-interviewed by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, even though they had already been extensively vetted and as a result granted refugee status in the United States. Under Operation Paris, USCIS is targeting refugees who have not yet received their green cards but are here in legal status. Most of them have applied for their green cards, but it takes 2 years after arrival in the United States for them to be granted, so many of those targeted could not have yet received them. The longstanding refugee program with clear protocols and security screenings is being scrutinized, as are their people who have come through this program. We are deeply concerned about the future safety and security of refugees and immigrants in our community. Sincerely, Jane Grotman, Executive Director. And so with that, we'll go to our final speaker, Dr. Bruce Corey, who's an economist. If you can hear us, Dr. Bruce,
yes,
please proceed
I do.
And introduce your name for the record.
Good morning, co-chairs Vang and McDonald and vice chairs Hussein and Scarbar and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Bruce Corey. I'm an economist, professor emeritus with Concordia University, and for a long time have been active in research on economic impacts of different activities. I want to share with you the powerful role of culture and the arts in economic development and the critical moment we are at this time. I'm going to put some slides up as I speak, and the work that I do is around also around this concept called cultural destinations. You heard from Vamento about Little Mekong, and a similar parallel effort on another corner of University of Snelling was in St. Paul is Little Africa. Now these are powerful, is a powerful model of economic development, and Vamento and Dr. Jean Galgalou were pioneers in building up this vision, and they've done it over almost more than a decade. It takes so long to build up the vision. It's a big difference from an ethnic restaurant or a corridor with many cultural businesses. A cultural destination or a business is one that activates art and culture and music in a consistent manner such that it offers an experience, as you can see on these slides, of people experiencing African culture at Little Africa Fest. And so this very powerful model creates a destination and experience, and people come and they have joy, and the entrepreneurs have joy as well as build wealth. And so it's a very powerful strategy of economic development built on joy. So I was, and many in the community were concerned and disappointed that Little Africa Fest that had been happening for the last 13 years is not going to happen this year because of the recent conditions of fear and anxiety. I want to share some data on an economic impact of what if Little Africa Fest stopped. And so using some very conservative estimates, I've come up with about a $3.8 million impact on St. Paul and Little Africa and Minnesota because of the vibrant energy created by Little Africa and the team there, AEDS. And for every dollar spent, there's a return of almost $2 in economic benefit. So if we don't have this impact, as the cancellation of Little Mekong, which will be much larger, you will see immediately about a $300,000 economic impact gone, which includes areas like visitor spending of $100,000 and the resources that AEDS deploys for about another $150,000, the business revenue lost not only of the vendors, but the area businesses that benefit from an event like this. And most important, as Vamento also testified, it's this model of cultural destinations, culture-based strategy that is at in crisis. So the cost goes beyond economic and fiscal. We can estimate the fiscal benefits of a festival. The infrastructure for a culture-based development model losing one of its core elements. The public safety benefits when neighbors around that park come and say, oh, thank you for organizing this event because it helps reduce crime, it helps remove people, activities that we don't want here, and makes it more family friendly. It's the marketing and branding that small businesses get through visibility, and it creates this sense of culture and belonging. It creates joy, cultural affirmation. There are people, Africans, who would say, hey, I'm glad you're celebrating Africa, me, Africa, in the heart of the of Minnesota. Thank you for doing it. And as Chair Vang said about going to Little Mekong Night and enjoying it, it fills people with pride, but it also fills not only ethnic communities, but other visitors and the artists and the residents, and the same time it builds wealth. So the reversal, when AEDS is doing, just like Vamain mentioned, AEDS has repurposed the funds that they had set up for the fairs to small grants for business struggling right now in an emergency grant program. This is reversing this model back to a survival mode. And it has a lot of implications, economic implications for Minnesota. And so what policymakers like you can do is to continue to fund the arts, especially these cultural destination, cultural corridors model of integrating culture into wealth building, because it provides spaces for people in Minnesota right now. We need these spaces where we enjoy each other's culture and build relationships. And there is a breaks return on investment of doing things like this. I read the testimony of the Hmong International Festival last night. And if I put those numbers, a grant from the legacy funds, about $300,000. There were 200 vendors, and there were about 47,000 people attending last year. If I put it into a similar model that I've done, it's about a $5 to $6 million impact, and it's a conservative impact. It's not including other larger citywide impacts or statewide impacts. And that's a big return on investment. An investment of $300,000 by the legacy funds yielding about a $6 million benefit. So you can see how powerful this model is, but also how powerful art and culture is to the life of Minnesota, and how people have so effectively used culture and art to not only bring life into spaces and events, but also to build wealth. And so I request you to, and thank you for funding the Arts and Culture Fund and keeping it open for business and economic development, and request you to continue to urgently fund more of these activities now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Bruce Corey. Any questions or remarks for the testifier? All right. I see none, Dr. Bruce. Thank you so much for testifying. Your insights are always great for us and helpful for us to hear, to put things into perspective of what types of investments are worth investing. And thank you for coming here today to provide that. Members, we have one. Dr. Bruce, do you have closing remarks?
Thank you, Chairman. May I just share that I've taken this model of cultural destination to the state fair, and hundreds of people have stopped by and said, cool, awesome. So it is a model that can be taken to small towns, large cities, and be very effective. But thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Bruce. Members, we do have one business item to do, which is one more, which is the approval of minutes. Do we have quorum? Yes. We do have quorum. So Chair Leon, would you move the minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to move the minutes for our previous meeting.
All right. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Before we adjourn, Representative Mamani Hitzley.
Thank you so much, Chair Vang, and the members of this committee and all the testifiers. I've been sitting here listening to all the testifiers, and I'm so happy and glad that it showed the diversity of our state. So as an immigrant legislator, as a first-time immigrant legislator, and as someone who is a proud Minnesotan, a proud Kenyan-American, I have seen firsthand the harm that ICE enforcement and Operation Metro Surge has caused in our communities. Families have lived in fear, and some still continue to live in fear. Parents left for work, unsure if they would make it back home to their children. Kids sat in classrooms worried about whether their mom or dad would be taken. Workers who've spent years contributing to the fabric, the economic fabric of this great state, building businesses, staffing our hospitals, caring for our elderly, and strengthening our neighbors were certainly treated as disposables or criminals. And let's be clear about something else. Many of the people targeted were citizens or had legal status. Yet entire communities were painted with the same brush and labeled as criminals. This kind of rhetoric does not harm individuals. It harms the dignity and the safety of entire communities and our state. The ripple effects has been real, and all of us have experienced it one way or another. In my own district, one of my favorite neighborhood coffee shops has permanently closed because they can't recover from Metro Surge. Those actions destabilizes families, businesses, and community spaces that hold neighborhoods together. But even in the midst of fear, Minnesota has shown up, and it has shown something powerful: community. Neighbors have come up and stood for neighbors. Businesses opened their doors and provided free food. Faith leaders and rapid response networks mobilized in real time for families and their neighbors, including my own. I was hosting family members who could not go back to their homes because they didn't know what was going to happen next. Most of us, especially legislators, were getting phone calls. We were on phone calls with family members who didn't even know where their loved ones were. Particularly coming from the Kenyan immigrant community, I was on phone calls in the middle of the night because I was talking to parents in Kenya because their international student was picked up who had legal status to be in this country, and they couldn't get a hold of their family members. Thousands protested peacefully. Community members watched over neighborhoods and schools. And in one powerful moment, two of my constituencies, Heather and Tippi, while doing what they were doing for their community, were detained. Still in handcuffs, one of the ICE agents had a seizure. And in that moment, they weren't thinking about, well, that's the other side. They were thinking about humanity. They requested to be released so that they can help that ICE agent who was having a seizure. They chose humanity in the middle of conflict. That's the Minnesota I know. That's the Minnesota I love. And Minnesota strengthened by the beauty and contributions of our immigrant communities. And we know that there's still work to do. One of the best examples of this effort that has gone into this was I was working with a family, a friend who was just looking out for his friend, and he was detained, and we have been working for a couple of weeks. And finally, I get a call from him, and he says, "Hey, Rep, I have somebody on the call for you." And that was his friend. He had finally flown back home, and he was back with his family. So this Minnesota that I love, that we all love, came together in the midst of such difficult times. And Minnesota has continued to prove that. We've done it during Dante Wright. We've done it during many, many difficult moments in this state. And we will continue to stand up for our neighbors and our families. Again, there's still work to do. There's trauma that we have to work through. But we must remember one thing. We are Minnesotans. And in the Swahili language, we say tunanguvu saidi pamoja, meaning we're stronger together. Thank you, Chair.
With that, this meeting is adjourned.